Good evening. My name is David McKnight, and I'm the director of UPenn's Rare Book and Manuscript Library. On behalf of the Vice Provost and Director of Libraries, Carton Rogers, it is my honor and pleasure to welcome you to the second lecture of the 81st Annual A.S.W. Rosenbach Lectures in Bibliography. As many of you know, the Rare Book and Manuscript Library has been closed for renovations during the past 2 years. I hope you enjoy the new state-of-the-art facility and welcome you back, newly minted, to the University of Pennsylvania Library's Special Collection Center. The Rosenbach Fellowship in Bibliography, established by the trustees of the University of Pennsylvania in 1928, honors a gift for that purpose from Philadelphia native A.S.W. Rosenbach, one of America's greatest book dealers and collectors. The purpose of the lecture series is to further scholarship and scholarly publication in bibliography and book history as broadly understood. Christopher Morley delivered the first Rosenbach lecture in 1931, and in the subsequent years, a who's who of scholars working in the field of descriptive bibliography and the history of the material text have delivered the Rosenbach lectures. On an international scale, the Rosenbachs are only rivaled, in my opinion, with the Panizzi lectures held annually at the British Library. Thanks to the generosity of Rosie Rosenbach, the University of Pennsylvania Libraries will be able to offer the lecture series long into the future. I speak with optimism because I believe, despite the marketing of e-books and e-readers and the plaintive ringing of the death knell for the printed word, that human communication itself, as represented in all its material forms, will continue to excite a passion for understanding the past, stimulate the collecting impulse, both private and institutional, generate public interest, and arouse scholarly inquiry into written forms, whether in print or digital formats, thus enabling the Rosenbach Lectures Selection Committee to bring to Penn's campus, as in the past, leading scholars in the field of bibliography and book history, and to share their research with you, the audience, and eventually revel in their lectures in print or to listen to them again and again in the form of podcasts freely available on the web. I'm pleased to announce the next two Rosenbach lectures. The first is Harvard professor Ann Blair, the author of Too Much to Know, Managing Scholarly Information Before the Modern Age. Ann will deliver the 2014 Rosenbachs, and William Zaks, independent scholar, who has built a world-class private collection focusing on the Scottish Enlightenment in the heart of Edinburgh, Scotland. Bill will give the Rosies in 2015. At this time, I would like to acknowledge and thank my fellow members of the Rosenbach Lectures Organizing Committee, which includes Jerry Singerman, Senior Editor for the Humanities at the University of Pennsylvania Press, Professors Peter Stollybrass, Walter H. and Lenore C. Annenberg Professor in the Humanities, and Professor of English and of Comparative Literature and Literary Theory, representing the Rare Book and Manuscript Library, Dr. Dan Traister, Printed Book Curator Emeritus, Mr. John Pollock, Rare Book Specialist, and two new members, Dr. William Knoll, Director of the Special Collections Center and Founding Director of the Schoenberg Institute for Manuscript Studies, and Jim Green, Chief Librarian at the Library of Company of Philadelphia. Approximately 8 years ago, the UPenn Press and the Rare Book and Manuscript Library entered into a fruitful partnership to select speakers for the Rosenbach Lectures. While we collectively fuss and mull over potential speakers, we have divided the labors as follows. The library sponsors and hosts the lecture series, and the press engages the speaker as author in terms of negotiating the publication of the lectures in book form. The press has the right of first refusal. Although we have lectures lined up through to March 2015, as I noted, the committee recently met, and I'm pleased to report that we are faced with a daunting list of remarkable potential speakers to choose from. I would like to point out that the press does have on display, just to my right here, a number of titles in the press's material text series. The series includes books which first appeared in the form of the Rosenbach Lectures. Among these titles on display, they include Robert Darton's The Devil in the Holy Water, David H. Hall's Ways of Writing, and Elizabeth Eisenstein's latest book, Divine Art, Infernal Machine, The Reception of Printing in the West, From First Impressions to the Sense of an Ending. Forthcoming is Alberto Manguel's 2011 Rosenbach Lectures, The Traveler, The Tower, and The Worm, The Reader as Metaphor. Before handing the podium over to this year's Rosenbach Lecturer, Paul Needham, I would like to take a moment to say a few more words of thanks, first and foremost, to Alita Arthurs and her staff for making travel arrangements for our speaker and organizing the reception last night. Secondly, I would like to thank Andrea Gottschalk, the Special Collections Center's exhibition coordinator and graphic designer par excellence, for the preparation and design of this year's poster. And thirdly, I'd like to thank Lloyd Frank, who's behind the scenes, for recording the lecture series. Additionally, I'd like to mention that tomorrow morning, in lieu of the regular meeting of the History of Material Text Seminar, Paul Needham will lead a seminar on incunables selected from the Penn Collection in the Lee Library, just behind us, at 11 a.m. I'd also like to remind you to please turn off your cell phones. At the conclusion of last night's first lecture, the 1450s Bookmaking Inventions, Paul Needham, Scheide librarian at Princeton University, led us back in time to Mainz, Germany, and the revolutionary typographic world of Johann Gutenberg, the inventor of movable type, and his complex personal and professional relationships with his contemporaries, Johann Fust and Peter Schuffer. Thanks to Gutenberg, Fust, and Schuffer, Mainz was the only city in Europe with printing press for a decade. Despite its novelty, the printing press was not a well-kept secret, as Paul demonstrated. Through the meticulous analysis of the evolution of Gutenberg's typeface, which appeared in the earliest printed book attributed to Gutenberg, the Sibylline book, printed as early as 1449, Paul continued his comparative analysis of the refinements of Gutenberg made to the DK or Donatus Kallen's typeface through the ensuing decade, with Gutenberg's typographic masterpiece, the 42-line Bible, which appeared midway in the first decade of printing with movable type in 1454. Brilliantly, Paul illustrated Gutenberg's genius to integrate scribal practice and artistry with the challenges of the innovative medium of movable type to create an instrument of human communication that would soon be unleashed on a global scale. Paul concluded his first lecture with a detailed discussion of the printing history of Gutenberg's Catholicon, dated to 1460. This evening, Paul Needham continues this journey with his second lecture, The 1460s, Slow Diaspora. Please welcome Paul Needham.
Good, thank you. Thank you very much, David. At the end of yesterday's lecture, we closed our view of the earliest European printing in Mainz in 1460, that year in which two shops, Gutenberg's and Fust's, each completed an imposing work, the Royal Folio Catholicon Dictionary from Gutenberg's press, printed from double-line castings, and the Imperial Folio Decretals of Clement V from the Fust and Schiffer shop. We noticed also that by the end of the 1460s, the major Mainz productions, relatively few in number, and all with either special vellum issues or even entirely printed on vellum, were marketed widely across Europe. In the years following, into the 1460s, not just finished printed books, but also the printing craft itself moved outside of Mainz, a movement whose picture is in some parts quite clear and in other obscure. The late 1450s and early 1460s were a deeply unsettled time in Mainz's history, with civil and ecclesiastical unrest that far surpassed in consequence the feuds between patrician and guild classes of the town in the earlier 15th century. The precipitating event was the election of a new archbishop in the spring of 1459. The Archdiocese of Mainz played a key role in the politics of the Holy Roman Empire. It was the largest church province of the empire, with the most extensive territories and greatest number of incorporated dioceses. The archbishop was the senior figure among the seven imperial electors, and he had the sole prerogative of calling the electors into assembly. The emperor, Frederick III, and the pope, who was now Pius II, that is, that same humanist, Aeneas Sylvius, who was the first explicit eyewitness of the Gutenberg-Fust Bible, And the grandee nobles of the empire all took intense and often conflicting interest in the See of Mainz. The successful new candidate for the Archbishopric of Mainz was Dieter von Isenburg, custos of the cathedral, and like almost all of the empire's prelates, he was of noble family. Within the cathedral chapter's small electoral committee, Dieter won a narrow 4-3 majority against Adolf von Nassau, another noble-born churchman. To win votes, to get his 4 votes, Dieter von Isenburg had had to make various concessions to political interests. And in particular, he promised to join a coalition which was opposed to the Elector Palatine, another of the 7 electors based in Heidelberg. This is Friedrich I. In June 1460, Dieter, newly elected as archbishop, personally joined the forces that fought the Elector Palatine's troops around Worms. In the unseemly battle, the Collegiate Church of St. Cyriacus of Neuhausen, which was just right outside Worms, was heavily damaged, and Friedrich's opponents were soundly defeated. Dieter was compelled to conclude a 20-year truce with the Elector Palatine, who is a figure disliked and mistrusted by both the emperor and the pope. And this mistrust rubbed off onto Dieter, as did also the pope's suspicions that Dieter was a conciliarist. As for the destroyed Collegiate Church of St. Cyriacus, it would have been personally familiar to Pius, for during his years in Germany, among other benefices, he had been provost of the cathedral in Worms. Pius quickly granted to the bishop of Worms and to the dean of its cathedral, whom he knew very well, authority to issue indulgences for repairing the church. But Dieter's troubles with Pius II continued. He contested the pope's demand for a large pallium tax, a large sum of money that every German bishop had to pay to be invested, which Pius had doubled beyond the traditional tax. In August of 1461, with the agreement of Emperor III, Dieter was formally deposed by the pope, and the under-candidate, Adolf von Nassau, was provisionally named archbishop. In the spring of 1462, both Dieter and Adolf published statements arguing their competing claims of legitimacy. They also took to arms, a not unprecedented event in the annals of imperial ecclesiastical politics. Earlier in the century, rival claimants to the electoral sees of Trier and Cologne had done just the same thing. An archdiocese was worth some bloodshed. In the early summer of 1462, the armor supporting Dieter, led now by his new friend, the Elector Palatine, appeared to have defeated Adolf's coalition decisively. But then in late October of 1462, Adolf's regrouped forces were able to capture the city of Mainz itself, which had declared itself for Dieter, and Adolf took physical possession of the cathedral. As punishment to the city, which had made this very impolitic choice of favorite, Adolf abolished the 200-year-old liberties of the Mainz citizens, 800 of whom, perhaps all of the male burghers, were sent into exile, though for many it was temporary. If either Fust or Gutenberg was expelled, it was only for a brief period. These wars of religion, if we can call them that, brought work to Gutenberg's shop and even more to Fust's. On commission from the Dean of Worms Cathedral, both shops printed in 1461 and again in 1462, indulgence forms for St. Cyriacus of Neuhausen, seven different editions in all, printed on vellum and each attested by a single survivor, including, in fact, 2 that don't survive and yet were recorded in the past. This indulgence campaign must have been well organized and widespread. Besides Neuhausen itself, manuscript fulfillments on several of the surviving indulgence forms show that they were issued, that is, sold in the Diocese of Cologne, in Württemberg, and in Vienna. The total of copies printed, As with the 1454-55 indulgences for the defeat of Cyprus, is surely to be numbered in the thousands. It is by this means, and not by looking in monumental books, that tens of thousands of people in these years, literate or not, would have seen their first printing. The indulgence form you see here was printed in Gutenberg's shop using the Catholicon type, but here the actual type was used to print rather than castings. And so, in fact, it's a very sharp printing, doesn't come through fully in this photograph. The indulgence here that you see was printed in Fust's shop using the type he had used to print the 1459 Durandus. And for this, presumably Peter Schiffer himself, now I don't know if this will work, also cast a new, very handsome calligraphic initial to go at the beginning. And so this is the first time that this particular initial was made and used. Take that away. Try to take that away. This is, well, now this has become, there, more annoying than it was yesterday. In those same years of 1461, 1462, Fust's shop was apparently commissioned by both antagonists of the Cathedral War, that is, both Dieter von Isenburg and Adolf von Nassau, to print a variety of documentary broadsides. And we'll put one of them up on the screen. These included Pius II's official statements deposing Dieter and instituting Adolf, a statement of Frederick III against Dieter, a manifesto by Dieter, a counter-manifesto by Adolf. There are 13 such editions in all, printed on paper, including duplicate editions of four of the documents, so again, they must have been rather widely spread. One of these, Dieter von Isenburg's open letter to the Estates of the Empire, was the largest item of printing so far created. Largest, that is, in the area of its type page. This is not the one we see here. This occupied the entire side of an unfolded royal sheet, so that the platen of the press must have measured roughly 50 by 35 centimeters. Conceivably, a special press was built to accommodate this, for a platen so large would have been a hindrance to working off smaller forms of type, even imperial folios. In the aftermath of the Cathedral War, the traditional independence of the Mainz burghers as against the archbishop was shattered, and Fust's own printing enterprise was set back, very likely from a lack of available money to borrow for large printing projects. In August 1462, Fust and Schiffer had finished a beautiful royal folio Bible in two volumes, further notice of which we will briefly postpone. After that, the shop seems to have fallen almost dormant for 3 years, until late 1465. Within these years, the only printing jobs that survive, at least, were small. Two folio format but pamphlet size editions, one in Latin and one in German, of a crusading bull promulgated by Pius II in the autumn of 1463. As for Gutenberg, the only other piece of printing that we know he carried out with his Catholicon type is a 1464 dated indulgence for the Trinitarian Order, whose chief mission was the redemption of Christian captives of the Turks. It has often been supposed that Mainz's collapse in these years led to a diaspora of printing craftsmen that spread the technology from Mainz to new towns. There is reason to give weight to this general idea, even if it cannot be pursued to certainty. However, printing began to be carried outside Mainz several years before the Cathedral War began, and four distinct channels can be identified. Two of these are projects centered in Bamberg and Strasbourg, respectively, and are almost mirrors of each other. For both were concerned with the printing of a large format Vulgate Bible, that is Latin Bible, by printers who were also diocesan officials. Two other channels, one in the Lower Rhine region and the other in Bavaria and Austria, involve typographic printing on a much smaller scale. The courses of these two channels are much less clearly traceable, but they are of great interest, in part because of their mysteries. It was noted at the end of the first lecture that in the late 1450s, Gutenberg sold his DK type, his large type, to Bamberg in Upper Franconia, essentially up the River Main. Although we have no direct details of this sale or arrangement, it is very likely that Mainz printing shop workers also removed to Bamberg. The DK type was used there to produce a Royal Folio Latin Bible. We'll put up just a section of one of its pages, of the same general style as the Gutenberg and Fust Bible. The larger size of the DK font meant that it would fit comfortably on a Royal Folio page, that is, with appropriately large margins, when it was set to double columns of 36 lines, as here, as against the 42 lines of the Mainz Bible font. And you may recall that in his own latest printing with the DK type in Mainz, Gutenberg had begun to print a 40-line Bible in this font that would have required an imperial folio format, of which only a partial proof of one early page survives. There is reason to wonder whether the Bamberg DK type Bible is a kind of second stage of what was Gutenberg's plan in Mainz. The Gutenberg proof from Mainz preserves text from Genesis chapters 3 and 4, and its text readings show that its setting copy was not the Gutenberg Fust Bible, but some, of course, unidentified manuscript Bible. And this is very similar to the situation with the Bamberg 36-line Bible, which you see here. Like the Gutenberg Fust Bible, it was divided for production into four text units for concurrent independent composition. The first two units to go to press being Genesis, prefaced by two traditional Jerome prologues, and First Chronicles. The earliest pages in these two sections were likewise set from a manuscript and not the Gutenberg Fust Bible. But then, after that, early on, a copy of the Gutenberg Fust Bible was procured in Bamberg and became the setting copy for the remainder of the job. Unfortunately for our question of a potential connection with Gutenberg's Bible experiment, by the time Genesis chapters 3 and 4 was set in the Bamberg shop, that setting copy of the Gutenberg Bible was already on hand. The Bamberg 36-line Bible was almost certainly printed under the supervision of Albrecht Pfister, longtime secretary of the recently, May 1459, elected bishop Georg von Schaumburg, who had been before his election the provost of the cathedral. From a rubricator's date in one copy, we know that the Bible was completed in 1461, no later than 1461. Being set in a large font with only 36 double columns per page, it was, in terms of leaves, 3/8 longer than the Gutenberg Fust Bible, about 880 versus about 640 leaves. And a number of original buyers found it more convenient to bind their copies in three volumes rather than two very fat ones. There was an issue on vellum besides paper, but the presumably few vellum copies were all eventually discarded by their owners, leaving traces only in the form of scattered binding waste. The paper of the Bamberg Bible, like that of the Gutenberg Fust Bible, is Italian, but imported from mills not in the Piedmont, but rather in the Veneto and the Marches of Italy, at least one of the stocks being probably from the ancient papermaking town of Fabriano. These many dozens of reams of royal paper probably made their way to Bamberg through the Brenner Pass and through the Tyrol. The distribution of the Bamberg 36-line Bible was much more regional than that of the Gutenberg Fust Bible. There is strong evidence that the Bishop of Bamberg was personally interested in, and very probably invested heavily in, the production of the Bible, that is, not from personal funds, but from funds of the cathedral, which he controlled. He was the donor of several copies to nearby religious houses, including to the Carthusians of Nuremberg, to a Franciscan convent in Coburg. And a colleague of mine very recently discovered
in unpublished book dealer correspondence of the early 19th century that yet another copy, as it happens, the copy in the Scheide Library, was given to Kloster Aurach by Bishop Georg in 1468 to alleviate his sins, as the inscription wrote. That inscription, the book dealer in the early 19th century wrote, "Be sure not to lose this," and the book was rebound and it was lost. At the same time, perhaps even a little earlier, another Royal Folio Latin Bible was produced in Strasbourg, the first printing from the city that had been the longtime residence of Gutenberg, and that is what you see here. Like the Gutenberg Fuss Bible and the Bamberg Bible, the Strasbourg Bible is anonymous and undated, but a rubricator's inscription in one copy proves that printing was complete in 1460. The text source was a copy of the Gutenberg Fuss Bible, another copy of the Gutenberg Fuss Bible. Two copies of this Strasbourg Bible, the Mentelin Bible, contain or once contained an acrostic Latin commendatory poem spelling out the name of the author of the verse, Sigismundus. This is probably a Benedictine monk named Sigismund Meisterlin, who for a Benedictine seemed to travel to way too many places, and followed by the name of the printer, Johannes Mentelin. And the verses refer to the printing process, but in extremely obscure terms. And one of these two copies also contains another more accessible set of commendatory verses by the German humanist Rudolf von Langen, who at the time lived in Basel. And he thought it appropriate to compare Mentelin's achievements in making the Bible with the conquests of Alexander the Great. Mentelin, who had been born in Celestat, became a Strasbourg citizen in 1447, a year when it's possible but not certain that Gutenberg was a resident. Mentelin is recorded as an Episcopal notary, and like Peter Schiffer, must have been known as a skilled calligrapher. One document refers to him as a scriba per ornatus, a thoroughly equipped scribe. This probably allows us to see Mentelin's own design in the very unusual type with which the Bible was printed. Although, if you have to class it at all, you have to class it as a Gothic rotunda. It contains humanist elements, most notably the bold and broad ampersand, which I will bring to your attention, which is as bold as an advertisement, the sort of thing a calligrapher might do. The font is smaller and more compressed, compressed vertically or horizontally, that is squished along a horizontal line, than either the DK or Gutenberg Fuss Bible fonts, with the result that, again, let's make it go away, that by number of leaves, the Mentelin Bible was about half the length of the Bamberg Bible, and some copies were originally bound, in fact, in a single volume. The paper for this Bible came from the same Piedmont mills that provided for the Gutenberg Fuss Bible and for the 1460 Mainz Catholicon. That is, it moved along the same trade routes. No copies of the Mentelin Bible are known on vellum. The chief distributionary of Mentelin's Bible was not just the region around Strasbourg, but also across the empire to the east, to Swabia, Bavaria, and Austria. Only a few copies seem to have been sold northward. In 1460, as has just been discovered in recent weeks by a colleague of mine in Augsburg, Mentelin also printed an indulgence form for the repair of St. Cyriacus in Neuhausen, so that Neuhausen, Worms, situated between Mainz to the north and Strasbourg to the south, took advantage of both towns for help in its church repair campaign. Then, in 1462, the shop of Fust and Schiffer printed a fourth edition of the Latin Bible, which you see here, again a royal folio, of which there were substantial issues on both paper and vellum, the vellum copies predominating significantly. The paper copies, again, were supplied by the Piedmontese mills already mentioned. Once more, the Gutenberg Fust Bible was used as copy source. So here's a third copy of the Gutenberg Bible used as setting copy. And a recent discovery has shown that two copies of the Gutenberg Fust Bible were lightly marked by the compositors of this Bible. That is, they do physically survive. That is, those copies remained with Fust and Schiffer as unsold copies about 7 years after they were printed. The edition size of the 1462 Bible must have been somewhat greater than that of the Gutenberg Fust Bible, for it has a considerably larger survival. The 1462 Bible was more ambitious in its printing techniques than any other of these early printed Bibles, with a serious attempt, as with the two Mainz Psalters, to replace most, though not all, of the work of the Rubricators with red-printed chapter initials. Not here. This is a space for an illuminator to fill in. Most of the chapter initials were drawn from the Lombard set of the smaller Mainz Psalter type, but some were newly made. The red-printed book and prologue titulae, and that's what you see here, the beginning, the end of the book of Judith, the beginning of the book of Hester, printed in red ink. Printed, in fact, the same pole of the press as the black ink. And it also had red printed chapter numbers. And these chapter numbers were small cast blocks carrying all the Roman numerals on a single piece, which then could be reused for various books of the Bible, sort of a mini Catholicon form of printing. At an intermediate stage, there was an attempt within all four of its composition units to print the chapter initials and numbers alternately in red and blue. The attempt was abandoned, but thereafter the initials that would have been blue were printed in blind so that the rubricators would have a very precise model to fill in with their blue ink. And in a later advertisement of books for sale, Schiffer referred to this Bible as a Biblia Pulchra, and it must have seemed so to 15th century eyes, as it does to ours. Copies were sold very widely, including to England, France, Hungary, Bohemia, Italy, even the Baltic, and many copies have added illumination of high quality, this copy being about as high as you can get. The production of four Latin Bibles in these early years is a strong argument that printed books not only found a market, but could create a market. We may imagine that the hundreds of religious houses and churches that acquired them, not infrequently through the offices of a well-off benefactor, were not strictly speaking lacking in copies of the Bible. But handsome new copies in clear black letters, and all four editions are notably handsome works, were seen as desirable additions. We might say that a fashion for new Bibles developed. Only a genuine fashion could account for these large investments by many buyers, made larger in many cases by additional costs for illumination. Similarly, but at the opposite end of the scale, the massive issue of printed broadsides and especially indulgence forms shows how printing was seen from very early times as adaptable to very practical non-literary uses. And here, too, I suspect, that the cleanness and neatness of the printed indulgence forms was itself an advantage to the indulgence campaigns. We referred a few minutes ago to two mystery channels of printing. These channels raise the question even of whether all European typography descended from Gutenberg, came out of Mainz, or whether there may have been something like reinventions. One of these channels centers roughly in Bavaria and Austria, and until recently has been almost invisible to book historians. The first quarter century of typography coincides roughly with an apparent expansion in the production and use of multiply printed images, especially woodcuts, but also metal cuts printed in relief, and engravings printed in intaglio under a rolling press. Print historians, by which I mean scholars of such pictorial repeated images, not of typography, have seen this germinal phase, as it's been called, of European printmaking as beginning a rapid expansion in the 1440s. This manifested itself in many cases in the addition of devotional prints to prayer books, more or less as substitutes for hand illumination. And in some cases, the cuts were even printed directly on the leaves of the books, so that there was a close planning of both written text and visual image. The first joining of prints with typography was carried out by an unnamed printer in Bavaria, although we're so uncertain of the location or locations, possibly plural, that even Bavaria is a slightly notional idea. In the late 1450s, I think it's plausible, or very early 1460s, not after 1461. This printer either owned or associated with a printmaker who owned a series of 20 octavo-sized metal cuts, sequence of the Passion of Christ. This anonymous printer produced a series of small editions in which the Passion cuts were placed against facing pages with German prayers appropriate to each image, these prayers being set typographically in a Gothic formal texture of font. The layout is similar to a group of manuscripts, some fragmentary, that likewise opposed the cuts to German prayers, but handwritten. Only one copy of this printed Leiden Christi survives in full, but scattered fragments of others indicates that at least six different editions were printed, and of course others beyond those six may have disappeared entirely. The printer, whoever he was, also owned or had access to a similar series of eight metal cuts representing the seven joys of Mary and then the death of the Virgin. And these two he printed with facing prayers in an octavo pamphlet known from a single copy, which you see here. The printing font of this pair of editions, or actually a group of at least seven, maybe eight or more editions, is roughly the height, the size of the Gutenberg Fust font, but is much less finished. It has a real peculiarity that instead of individual types for setting M and N, these letters were composed from types containing single minims. And so you see, like, here is an N, and it's two pieces of type. And here is another N, or it might be a V, I don't see the larger, two pieces of type. Here's another, and you see they all orient with each other differently. If you make a string of these and you play them in quick sequence, it looks like dancing minims. Don't know of any other font that did that, and it's not part of the Mainz idea of how you make types, and it's the thing that makes one wonder almost if this printer knew about printing and, so to speak, reinvented it in his own way. I'm about to assault this there. This font, but in a definitely later typographic state, was also used to print a broadside bloodletting calendar on a full sheet of chancery paper. Here we see the top half of it, again surviving as binding waste. And this calendar states in print that its new and full moon times are calculated on the meridian of Vienna. That's the word Wien that you see there, which I'm underlining. The true course in Vienna for the year 1462. These calculations to the hour and to the minute had to be entered in red ink using Arabic numerals by a rubricator. And here are the hours, and here are the minutes. And here's, they tell you it's the new moon, and here it's the full moon. So in fact, it's a, it's hybrid typography. It doesn't work in the least unless you also have the handwriting editions. It's not just the difficulty of figuring out what the initial of a chapter is, but the entire thing falls apart if you don't have both. Apart from one scribal error, these calculations are extremely accurate, and it's very plausible that they were provided by the astronomer Regiomontanus, who at some point late in the year left Vienna for Italy. This Vienna calendar was also illustrated, that is, besides its type, it uses two small woodcuts, which you see, representing the crescent moon and the full-faced moon. It seems necessary to guess, although it is only a guess, that the printer of this calendar in Vienna was Ulrich Hahn, who was later one of the earliest printers in Rome, and perhaps the earliest printer in Rome. Hahn was a native of Vienna, and it is at least to be noted that both he and Regiomontanus had been students at the University of Leipzig in the mid-1440s, and then that they both moved from Vienna to Rome, Regiomontanus in the service of Cardinal Bessarion, within a year or so of each other. The Leiden Christi font, the same font that we see here, disappears after the Vienna calendar, but the set of Leiden Christi metal cuts move from southern Germany to central Italy, where, probably about 1463, they were used to print in this same octavo format an Italian version of those same devotional prayers, the Passione di Cristo. Only a substantial fragment of one copy survives, and enough of a watermark is preserved to suggest that this Passione di Cristo was printed about 1463 in the rough vicinity of Bologna-Ferrara. The paper was made very much within that region, a very distinctive watermark. This fragment is probably, therefore, both the earliest surviving typographic printing and the earliest illustrated printed book made in Italy, as well as the first printing in the Italian language. This importation of the metal cuts strongly implies that the printer himself was an immigrant from Germany, as were all the known printers in Italy to the end of the 1460s. The font of this Passione di Cristi is new and unique to this edition, a curious, quite awkward rotunda with several unusually shaped characters. This one is very bizarre. That's actually the letter V. This font shows signs of having been made by cuneiform typography, as I outlined in the first lecture. By my count, this would be the 12th type font made since Gutenberg's first type font. The other mystery channel of early typography is that of what is commonly called Dutch prototypography, a name given to a group of types possibly used by more than one Netherlandish printer in more than one town, but all appearing in books that lack colophons, giving information on printer, place, or date. One and only one of these types, and we'll go to where you just see the first line of the type font I'm talking about, was clearly created, commonly called the speculum type, was clearly created before 1470. And the name given it comes because it was used to print four editions of a typological picture text, what you're seeing part of here, called the Speculum Humani Salvationis. But a better name for this font would be the Doctrinale type. For its heaviest use, and thus the chief book market for the owner of the type, was editions of the grammar verses of Alexander de Villadei, called the Doctrinale. With that same type are printed a number of editions of the Donatus grammar and of another elementary Latin text for memorization, the Distica Catonis, the Distics of Cato. In short, this was primarily the owner of this type, a publisher of schoolbooks. These schoolbooks, like the Mainz Donatuses, were all printed on vellum. They survive only as fragments retrieved from book bindings, and almost all came onto the rare book market from the 18th century onward, torn out of their bindings and sold without record of their sources, thus erasing a multitude of clues to their dates and sales area. Fortunately, one unused, that is unrubricated, doctrinale fragment survives in situ, in the Cologne binding of a paper book whose scribe dated his work in four places to the first half of the year 1463. It is almost certain, therefore, the Dutch printing of doctrinale editions began no later than 1463 and very possibly goes back to 1462. And this particular fragment is further precious, for it gives us clear evidence that the marketing of the speculum-type schoolbooks in question extended at this early date at least as far as Cologne. Even earlier dates for Dutch prototypography, of course, not impossible, but we lack evidence. Now, at this point, I'm going to declare a kind of intermezzo to consider for a few minutes the sizes of these earliest printed books and broadsides. The books referred to, I've constantly described them in terms of their formats and their paper sizes, for these are the two factors that determine the leaf sizes of the books. And it may be taken axiomatically that all printers and publishers had reasons to select particular sizes for particular printing jobs. If we do not consider these factors when we think about early printing, we are more or less intentionally choosing to be blind, or at least one-eyed. What we see in the first picture, and I have a librarian standing alongside the stack so that you can measure the books against how big is a librarian. We have a folio book, that is, each of these is a book printed with one leaf being one half of a sheet of paper, but in four sizes, and going downward, they're imperial, an imperial folio, then the next size down is royal, like the Gutenberg Bible and many others. The next size down is median, and we haven't quite yet discussed a book printed as a median folio, but it will come up. And then the smallest size is chancery, and you get an idea of the relative sizes. And here's another, an extension of that stack, going down with three more books, and here a Bic mechanical pencil gives you the necessary scale. So I'm sure you can do this in your heads, having seen that pencil. But here we have, after the chancery folio with the vellum tips on the binding, then we have that same chancery paper used to print in quarto format. That's this volume, which contains actually 15 such quartos. And then folded once again so that you have eighths of a sheet for each leaf for this book, which is a small collection of chancery octavo. And then you can get even smaller by folding again, although usually what you would do is tear the paper into a smaller unit and then perhaps fold some more. This is what I would call a 16mo, and that size was indeed used. Not in the 1450s and 60s, but in the 1470s, definitely. And just by the way, I'm going to go very rapidly back, now that we've mentioned chancery paper and full sheets of paper. We did actually see a chancery sheet of paper, and it has a very distinctive element to it, yes, which is here. This is one of those Mainz Cathedral War broadsides, a statement, an open letter of Pius II, Pius Episcopus Servus Servorum Dei, directed to Adolf of Nassau. In any case, this has wide lines. This is a full sheet, although a little cut down, of chancery paper. So they printed right across the sheet, and the distinctive feature it has is here, which any time you have a chancery sheet in front of you, you will see it if it's 15th century paper, and that is, it has a fold. And that fold came
when you bought the paper, you bought a ream of paper, and the sheets in that ream were all folded in half. And so anytime you printed, or if you were an artist and made a drawing on a full sheet of paper, this goes, you know, well into the 17th century, there's always a fold there. Collectors of prints tried extremely hard to get rid of that fold and sort of mangled prints while trying to iron them out, but it's always there. And it's a very good orientation point. Now we'll go very quickly back. Oh, and here is that 16 mo as read by a reader. And here's that 16 mo chancery paper sitting on top of the imperial folio. So you have another way of estimating the scale. When we know this paper format, when we know the paper size, when we know the number of sheets forming the edition, forming a single copy of the edition, we really can see the book immediately. We don't need anything more. Nobody has to say anything more. We can form a visual picture of that book very accurately. And then there's another thing you can do, and that is estimate the amount of typesetting in the edition, and it's well worth doing. The easiest way to calculate this is by the number of M's of setting. By M, I mean a square piece of type. I won't go into how you do it, but it's very easy to do. And then when you have all of that information, you've summed up the book as a physical production with everything with considerable accuracy. These are the elements that make up the physical job of producing a book in a printing shop, except for one more factor that typically we don't know and usually have to estimate, which is the print run. Now, we surveyed in brief form all the printing shops known to have been active before the mid-1460s, that is very roughly in the first 15 years of typography. No printing type has gone unmentioned. And these amount to a relative handful of editions located definitely in Mainz, in Strasbourg, Bamberg, probably also in Vienna, and then in some places in, we don't know where, in the Netherlands, in Bavaria, and in central Italy. And apart from school grammars, these earliest printing shops generally did not have programs of continuous printing, that is, a steady output. The large and ambitious books produced by Fust and Schoeffer, by Gutenberg's Catholicon type shop, by Mentelin and the first Bamberg press, may be thought of as individual projects, and it is likely that the printers took on one project when and insofar as they found financing for that single project. We have noted the three-year near hiatus in Fust and Schoeffer's shop before 1462 and 65. Similarly, after Mentelin completed printing his Latin Bible in 1460, there was a three-year hiatus until he began a new project, the first edition, again a royal folio, of the Secunda Secundi of Aquinas's Theological Summa, completed by Advent 1463. That book is, in terms of typesetting, about four-fifths that of the Latin Bible. And for this project, Mentelin made a new, smaller type, his first type disappearing. And then there was another hiatus in his shop until 1466. And then his printing becomes a little more continuous. He completed three books that year, including one very large book, the first printing of the Bible in German, in High German, again a royal folio. Now, two shops of the earliest years are exceptions to this picture of schoolbook editions in substantial numbers on the one hand and individual large projects on the other, plus indulgences. First, in the mid to later 1450s, Gutenberg's shop did use the DK type to print a number of calendrical broadsides and brief pamphlets, some of which we noted in the first lecture, but others besides. The scattering of survival of such works in single copies, and particularly in fragments,
including two that were discovered in the 20th century and then destroyed again, allow us to think that these are probably the remains of a more prolific program whose other products are entirely lost. And then, in Bamberg, in the years 1461 to about 1463, after that 36-line Bible was completed, Albrecht Pfister produced, in Chancery Folio, a series of 7 woodcut illustrated texts, 6 of which were in German, 1 in Latin, including 3 editions, one of which you see here, of the so-called Biblia Pauperum, that is, a life and passion of Christ linked with Old Testament prefigurations. And he also printed 2 editions of a fable collection in rhymed couplets called the Edelstein. All but one of Pfister's texts had strong existing traditions in handwritten books of the later 14th and early 15th centuries. Pfister's books, looked at together, present a clear program of producing, by combined typography and woodcut, a selection of current vernacular literature already familiar to Bavarian readers. Unlike the small Leiden Christi pamphlets with metal cuts, which are probably a year or so earlier, Pfister's books join woodcuts and text on the same pages. And in the first book, the Edelstein, completed on Valentine's Day, 1461, the woodcuts were printed in a second operation, fitting into spaces left blank by the typographic compositor. Pfister's editions put together amount to something over 200 edition sheets, and draw on about 400 woodcuts, a few full page, but most vignette cuts, meant to be worked into the pages with text. There is reason to think that the woodcuts were supplied by a printmaker from Nuremberg, about 30 miles south of Bamberg. In that same folio format, chancery folio format, Pfister printed an 8th edition, a German version of what's called the Processus Belial, in which Satan brings a suit of complaint against Jesus and Solomon sits as judge. This is probably his last book. Pfister died by the mid-1460s. And although it fits textually into just that same tradition of illustrated books, it has no woodcuts, which suggests to me that at the end, some serious disruption of the original plan for this book happened, such as the death of Pfister. These early examples of printed books with printed illustrations, the Pfister folios, the Leiden Christi, and the 7 Joys of Mary, the Italian Passione di Cristo, show that typography began to be merged with illustration prints concurrently with a different kind of book, the block book, in which images and associated text of a page were cut on a block together and were typically printed not under a press, but by rubbing on the back of paper laid over the inked blocks so that only one side of a sheet was printed. The 1460s were the flourishing age of block books, whose origin was in the Netherlands and then spread particularly into southern Germany. The texts configured into block books were relatively restricted in number. Most commonly, they were devotional tracts whose pictures served for meditation and mnemonics. The greatest number of editions, that is, individual series of woodblocks, belonging to just 5 texts, 2 of which we see here, the Apocalypse and the Song of Songs, that is not precisely the Old Testament Song of Songs, but a kind of meditation in which verses from the Song of Psalms were assimilated to the Virgin Mary. A rather violent assimilation, in fact. A purely textual work could also be cut in woodblock, and in fact, there's one here in Penn's collection. And there are remains of several block book sets, for instance, of the Donatus grammar, though none of them suggest a date as early as the 1450s. One copy of a block book Apocalypse edition, in fact, this one, has been dated from its paper stocks to the early 1450s, but this early date is somewhat puzzling, for all other copies printed from the woodblocks belong, by just the same evidence, to the mid-1460s. Essentially, the book markets of the 1460s for printed books and block books ran in parallel without notable competition. The closest approach to competition, though probably only hypothetical, came in the early 1460s when a block book Biblia Pauperum was issued in the Netherlands, while hundreds of miles away, Pfister in Bamberg was printing the same text using woodcuts and typography together. We cannot know how contemporary eyes would have judged the alternative ways of making this text if copies were placed side by side, but our own eyes tell us that the conspicuous distinction between the two is that the typographic Biblia Pauperum is much more legible. None of the block books present text in clear or elegant form, and in some of them the text is so badly cut as to be in parts illegible. The most pregnant development in typography in the mid-1460s was unquestionably its spread to Italy, first to Rome with a kind of sidebar for the monastery of Subiaco, and then to Venice. We know from the Passione di Cristo that Subiaco and Rome did not mark the very beginning of printing in Italy, but these are where large-scale printing began. In 1465, printing was accomplished at the ancient monastery of Subiaco, about 2 days' journey east of Rome via Tivoli. The printers who established a shop there were Conrad Sweinheim and Arnold Panartz of the Diocese of Mainz and Cologne, respectively. We have no earlier information on them beyond that Sweinheim is probably identical with the person of that name who matriculated at the University of Erfurt in 1455. It is very likely that the partners had worked in Mainz at Fust and Schiffer's shop and dispersed from there after the sack of Mainz in October 1462, but we have no positive information. Nor do we know why they would have chosen a remote monastery in which to set up a printing enterprise, beyond the vague hint that most of the Subiaco monks at this time were Germans and Austrians, allowing for the influence of a personal connection of some sort. Nor, to continue our litany of ignorance, do we know the source of their financing, nor whether they brought printing equipment with them or developed it all at Subiaco. What we do know is that they owned a single font of Antiqua or humanist type, the first Antiqua font to be made, and that they printed with it 4 editions, of which the first, as they explicitly stated later, was the Donatus Grammar. 300 copies completely disappeared. And yet, it's curious that essentially forgotten, there is one fragmentary survival of Donatus printed on vellum, which by strong probability was printed in Italy, and I would say in the early 1460s. Nothing about its survival history and context is known. The library that contains it might know more, but nobody's ever investigated it. The peculiar style of its awkward rotunda font is different from, and yet relatable to, the font of the Passione di Cristo of Circa 1463, which you see below it here. But I think there's no reason to suppose that this might be the lost Donatus of Sweinheim and Panartz in a font they replaced with their Antiqua, for their Antiqua font is very well made, whereas the Donatus font is conspicuously clumsy in its letter fittings. It would be strange for a printing shop to move so directly in short time from one very poor font for its first book to a really excellent font for its next 3. Sweinheim and Panartz, and here we see one of their Subiaco books, they completed in the late summer and fall of 1465 2 books. This is one of them, the Lactantius, in, as they later said, 275 copies each, the other being a Cicero text. And then they followed that in 1467 by the City of God of St. Augustine. And it's very curious that all 3 of these books have different formats. The Cicero was printed as a quarto using half sheets of paper, of royal paper. Then following it, the Lactantius was printed as a folio on median paper. And because we know their edition sizes, we can estimate how much paper they needed. Then there was a pause, or maybe just a slower production pace, until their 3rd and largest Subiaco book of June 1467, The City of God. A slow production is probably the more appropriate concept than a hiatus in printing. A manuscript still preserved at Subiaco, written on paper in the mid-15th century, was used as setting copy for the Augustine printed edition. And marginal annotations by the compositors record the days of the week, never on Sunday, when they did their composition, and also whether they reached a finishing point before dinner or after dinner, ante prandium, post prandium. So you know what was forefront in their minds as they finished their work, giving valuable clues to the progress of composition. It seems that Subiaco monks were the participants in this work, thereby fulfilling the Benedictine sanctum officium of copying text by selecting types from boxes rather than manipulating a quill. From comparing the handwritten exemplar of Augustine with a printed result, we can say that the text grew in beauty as it was transmuted into multiple copies. And here too, we can estimate the quantity of paper required for the job, about 75 reams. Then in the second half of 1467, Swinhelm and Panarts moved their printing operation to Rome. They were quartered in the Massimo Palace, not the one of today, but one destroyed in the 1520s. And by the end of that year, they had completed an edition of the familiar letters of Cicero using a new Antiqua type font, one that conformed more closely than the Subiaco font had done to humanist calligraphy, yet for all that, no handsomer. The City of God from Subiaco was heavily marketed in and from Rome. A Roman toll book records 60 copies of it being imported from Subiaco in January 1468. And even earlier, in November 1467, one of the papal secretaries, Leonardo Dati, recorded having bought his book from what he called those Germans who make innumerable books, not by writing, but by printing. In the years 1468 and 69, Swinhelm and Panarts were very active as printers in Rome. Much of their output was selected and edited by a papal curialist, Giovanni Andrea Bussi, absentee bishop of Illyria in Corsica, who had been for some years earlier in the decade the secretary of Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, and who had returned to Rome from a diplomatic mission in Venice in late 1467, just about the time that Swinhelm and Panarts had removed from Subiaco. This Rome program of printing included church fathers and also particularly Latin classical editions, most with dedications by Bussi to Pope Paul II, successor to Pius II. Swinhelm and Panarts were not the first printers in Rome. And in fact, there is something slightly puzzling about these earliest years of Rome printing, which might be encapsulated as more printers than books. One and only one printed book, which you see here, was probably produced in Rome in 1466. This was the Meditations of Cardinal Juan de Torquemada, a very striking median folio illustrated with woodcuts and set with a large, bold, rotunda type. And its colophon states that it was completed in Rome by Ulrich Hahn on the last day of December 1467. Now, that date is most likely, not quite certainly, to be interpreted rather as 31 December 1466. For a common dating style of the papal chancery changed the year date at Christmas rather than at New Year's. These meditations were produced at the direct instigation of Torquemada, who was the first person to see his literary work in printed form. The text is his series of meditations and a sequence of frescoes that he commissioned for his convent in Rome, the Reformed Dominican House of Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, that had been personally granted to him in 1461 by Pius II. The woodcuts, probably cut by a German printmaker, presumably followed the iconography of the now lost frescoes, which were obliterated in the later 16th century. Hahn's unusually bold and wide rotunda type was also probably designed specifically for this edition, for it is not well suited to other forms of text reproduction on other sizes of page. These printed meditations of Torquemada may be seen as a kind of portable tour of the cloister of the convent. We may suppose that visitors to the cloister took it away, bought it, that is, as a sort of pilgrimage memento, and all four surviving copies of the book are outside Italy, in Spain, Germany, Austria, and, well, Great Britain, but coming from Germany. The meditations of Torquemada are therefore either a year earlier, 1466, or closely contemporary with the Rome printing of Swinhelm and Panarts. Whichever of those date interpretations is correct, it's somewhat strange that apart from the Torquemada, no other book is a candidate for being printed in Rome before Swinhelm and Panarts arrived. And yet, from various documents, datable from about 1464 to 66, we know the names of four or five Germans resident in Rome, and also several native Roman investors who were or became involved in printing projects. Ulrich Hahn and his son Heinrich, who had come from Vienna, Sixtus Riesinger, who had come from Strasbourg and presumably from Mentelin's printing shop, Georg Axel from Bavaria, Adam Roth from the Diocese of Metz. Before 1470, outside of Swinhelm and Panarts' shop, only three books are explicitly dated, all from the shop of Ulrich Hahn. To complete a review of printing in the late 1460s, we have to return to Northern Europe and first to Strasbourg and Mainz. In Strasbourg, we noted that in 1466, Mentelin produced three books, including the first German Bible. Nothing from his press can be reliably assigned to 1467, but then again, almost none of his books contain colophons. Then, not after 1468, he printed an edition of The City of God with long commentaries by the English Dominican, 14th century Dominicans, Thomas Wallace, Nicholas Trevet. And in 1469, he completed at least four editions, two of them substantial royal folios. A second printing shop operated in Strasbourg no later than 1466, which was that of Heinrich Eggestein. Mentelin and Eggestein would have known each other well, for both had positions in the Episcopal Chancery. Eggestein was the keeper of the bishop's seals. It is close to certain that Eggestein would also have known Gutenberg during Gutenberg's Strasbourg years. In the early 1440s, they were both part of a non-citizen watch guard drafted to help protect the city against the bands of mercenaries known as Armagnacs, who had devastated the countryside and threatened the city, egged on by the King of France. Eggestein's printing in the 1460s consisted of three editions in royal folio of the Latin Bible, plus a kind of supplement of biblical proof texts on the virtues and vices in the same format. And all three Bible editions used the text of the Gutenberg Bible. And in the case of the third edition, the actual copy used by Eggestein's compositors with rather extensive marginal emendations survives. The two type fonts in which they were printed both are modeled on Peter Schuffer's 1462 Bible font. There's reason to think that Mentelin and Eggestein cooperated with each other rather than competed. For going well into the 1470s, they never both printed the same text, whereas Eggestein certainly competed with Peter Schuffer in the marketing of large folio canon law texts. There is further reason to think that Eggestein might, in the late 1450s, have been the active figure in bringing printing to Strasbourg. In 1457, he resigned his citizenship and then resumed it again in 1459. And so, again, we can't help supposing, though we have no proof at all, that this was a period of absence when he was in Mainz and learning the crafts of printing, which would have meant paying money to somebody in Mainz. In Mainz, in the second half of the 1460s, two of the triumvirate who first developed typographic printing died. Johann Fust in the fall of 1666 in Paris, where he must have been carrying books for sale, such as the 1462 Bible, and Johann Gutenberg in early 1468. In early 1465, Gutenberg had been installed by the Archbishop of Mainz in the Archbishop's household with a pension. And although no reason is specified in the patent, It must have been in recognition of his invention. It is probable that from this time Gutenberg lived at the archiepiscopal residence in Eltville, a quasi-suburb of Mainz, where the document of installation was issued. In any case, a typecase or more of his Catholicon font went to Eltville, where two brothers named Bechtermünze used it in 1467 to print quartos, a Latin-German dictionary called the Vocabularius Ex Quo, and then they used it again in 1469 for another edition and a reprint of the Catholicon Press Aquinas tract, De Articulis Fidei. After Fuss died, the printing shop made a smooth transition. Peter Schiffer married Fuss' daughter, though we don't quite know the date, probably soon after Fuss' death. Fuss' widow also remarried, and all of the parties joined by these two marriages seem to have had an ownership share in the printing enterprise. Royal Folio edition of Aquinas Secundus Secundi, printed by Schiffer, gives only his name in the colophon, and he printed other substantial works in the later 1460s. At the same time the printing began in Rome, it also began in Cologne, in the shop of Ulrich Zell, whose first book, a brief chancery quarto meditation on Psalm 50 by St. John Chrysostom, translated, is signed by Zell and dated 1466. Zell was a native of Hanau, about 15 miles east of Frankfurt, and it has always been accepted that he learned printing in the shop of Fust and Schiffer, then moved to Cologne as part of the diaspora after the disruptions of the Mainz Cathedral War. Zell matriculated in the arts faculty of Cologne's university in June of 1464, and again, it has been accepted plausibly that the privileges of the university may have been helpful to his activity in the book trade, perhaps as an agent for Fust and Schiffer. Zell's first two printing fonts, one of which used only as titling, are closely modeled on Schiffer's fonts. And we see one of his earliest pieces of printing on screen. In the pattern of most of the early German printers, Fust and Schiffer being the exception, the large majority of Zell's books lack colophons. In the years from 1466 to 1469 and then onward, Zell issued many dozens of editions, but he signed and dated only one other of them to 1467. A chronological frame for his output must be teased out from the evidence of small typographical developments, the sequence of his paper stocks, and a group of extremely welcome dated acquisition and rubrication inscriptions. From the composite of this, we can say that Zell printed probably 50 or more chancery quarto editions between 1466 and 69. And they show that Zell aimed at a very well-defined pastoral and monastic market, at first local, but by 1469 expanding into sales reaching into southern Germany. The center point of his program was the prolific pastoral and meditative doctrinal writings of the French theologian and conciliarist Jean Gerson, who died in 1429. We may guess that Zell acquired setting copy for his texts from more or less the same religious houses as those to which he sold his printed copies. Especially noteworthy is a surviving volume that contains four of our earliest books together with an inscription recording that Magister Ulricus, Pressor Librorum, had given the volume to the Carthusian House in Cologne. All these books, successfully marketed, were printed with a relatively small typographic equipment, and in particular with a small press, whose platen only had to be large enough to cover the types of a single quarto page, about 4 by 7 inches. Part of Zell's scheme of publication was that various tracts could be selected and bound together according to a particular interest or need. And in this region, where he sold, a great many handwritten codices of similar content were also paper chancery quartos. So the various copies of Zell's quartos are, and earlier many more were, in bindings with such handwritten texts. Oddly, in 1469, though undated, Sell did print one large royal folio, part one of Aquinas' Summa, this being the first edition. It's been suggested that this out-of-series work reflects a business arrangement with Peter Schuffer, who the same year in the same format printed an even lengthier Aquinas text, Aquinas' commentary on the fourth book of Peter Lombard's Sentences. This single work by large work by Zell involved more typesetting than all his quartos to date put together. And then the introduction of printing to two more cities brings us to the end of the decade. In March 1468, in Augsburg, Günther Zeiner completed a chancery folio edition of a very popular Franciscan devotional treatise, The Meditations on the Life of Christ. The next year, he signed an edition of a treatise on the sacraments and on hearing confession by a Bamberg theologian, Johannes Auerbach. And it should be noted that that second book Zeiner printed, this is his first book, and here's the date, the fourth Ides of March in the year 68, and here's his name, Gintherum Dictum Zeiner of Reutlingen, where he was born. The second book he printed was the same tractate that Nicholas of Cusa, in his German visitations in the 1450s, he considered very inadequate, and it specifically wanted to supersede with Aquinas' De Articulis Fidei. So these two competing manuals for priests were both printed in the early years. The Auerbach tract continued to be used in southern Germany, despite what Nicholas said, and so it had its market there. And so Zeiner printed with some knowledge a book that would be useful to the parish priests of his own region. We can suggest with fair confidence that Zeiner must have been introduced to printing in Strasbourg. In 1463, he had gained citizenship in Strasbourg by marriage to the daughter of a Strasbourg citizen. And 2 years later, his brother Johann, who became the first printer of Ulm, trod that same happy path of romance and citizenship. The last printing shop of the 1460s is in many ways the most fateful of all, and we can say that of it that the most useful contribution this printer made to the advancement of the printing book trade was to die. This is not a book he printed, but this is a printer dying. The shop is that of Johannes de Spira, Hans of Speyer in Venice. Very little is known of him. But at this time, there were many German merchants in Venice. They had their own trading house and warehouse. And we guess that Johannes had been resident in Venice for about a decade before his printing began and ended in the year 1469. For we know that in some earlier year, he married the wealthy widow of an Italian, and she already had two children at the time of their marriage. They then went on to have two more children, and one was a daughter who was old enough to be married in 1477. Three editions and a handsome Antiqua font, we'll look at one in the third lecture on Thursday, are explicitly signed by Johannes de Spira in Venice and dated to 1469. Two editions of the familiar letters of Cicero, in the first edition and royal folio of the Natural History of Pliny. All three of these have grandiose verse colophons. The colophon of the second printing of the Cicero says that he printed 300 copies, and that in fact he printed 300 copies of both his editions. And in September of 1469, Johannes asked for and was granted by the Signoria of Venice a 5-year monopoly on printing in the Veneto, and his supplication refers to the Cicero and the Pliny as already existing. And so, with his patent in hand, he began printing a royal folio edition of the City of God, but he died while it was underway, and his brother Vindelin records, took over the completed printing in the year 1470. And this is where, with cold retrospection, we see the bright side of the unfortunate event. In 1470, printing expanded rapidly in Venice, which became the chief breeding ground of the growing printed book trade in the immediately following years. A monopoly on printing in so vital a trading center, assuming that is that Johann of Spira's monopoly could have been maintained, would not have been to the advantage of anyone beyond the printer. Thank you.
We do have time this evening for questions. Ellen Evans, one of our Harvey Mell staff members, is happy to extend the microphone to her, so please speak into the microphone. Questions?
We have to have a question. Someone in there.
I can just speak up.
Oh, yeah.
The gap of Mifflin's production, is it possible that he was producing folios in a few leaves for cash over the counter to subsidize the larger production?
I don't think so, but of course it's the kind of thing that you can't either prove or disprove. But, you know, Mentolin in particular, apart from that one very recently discovered indulgence, I mean, discovered in the year 2013 by a friend of mine in Augsburg, he printed almost no small books. I mean, that just never in his program do small books occur. So if you say that he might have, yes, he might have, but you can't even point to anything in his general form of printing that would make you think yes, probably, or even yes, very likely.
Produce folio vernacular medical books?
Not Mentolin, I believe. We'll both go to ISTC online and do competing searches and see what we turn up.
To go back to the beginning, Gutenberg had that real rough type. It was used for both Donatus school books in Latin.
Yeah.
And the, I want to call it the Sibylline Oracles. Okay, you're not saying that the first printing was definitely in the vernacular.
Well, I mean, there's this group of fragmentary printing for Donatus's and this Sibyllin book using the same type in the same state, extremely crude state. There's nothing, well, you know, actually one somewhat erratic but very brilliant German scholar said that one of the Donatus's he thought was even earlier than the Sibyllin book. And I looked at my notes. I took extensive notes on this man's writings years ago. And I remember thinking, yes, he probably was right. So I think the type was designed to print Donatus, the Donatus school grammar.
Okay. I'm a Chaucerian, and I've always been saying that England was the first to print. England was the first country to print in the vernacular for their
version. Oh, no, it was not. No. You'll have to change what you say at that point. Italian, German, French all preceded printing in English.
I mean in England, but in its own vernacular. They didn't print anything in Latin before printing. Caxton did not print anything in Latin.
Well, he printed an indulgence in Latin, which is probably his first piece of printing in England, in Westminster. So everything has a a caveat or a codicil attached to it. It's pretty early, yeah.
I've got a question related to Bruce's question, which is you said there were these hiatuses in printing, and I'm just wondering whether it's likely that you're recouping your costs after printing a book by printing, doing job printing again.
The thing I've never understood about that kind of argument is that to print a big book, let's say the Vulgate Bible, just because that was the most frequently printed of the big books, the cost of that, how could printing a group of smaller books on small paper, how could that ever build up the amount of money you need just to buy the paper for the bigger one. I just don't see it as a procedure. German scholars say this all the time about this, what do they call it, sort of Brotdruck or something that earns money. And I mean, it can earn money, but it's not the way to get the substantial investment that you need to print a big book. Well, everybody needs cash flow at all times. Yeah, but you know, you can say that, but I still think that big printing jobs were separate investments. That you know, once we get to Italy, as I'll mention on Thursday, where we actually have documents surviving, we see in many quite early cases the number of investors who stood behind one particular printing job, say to print one large text of civil law. The printers you know, typically would try to put as little money into it as they could. I mean, occasionally a printer, but it was probably a bad decision, might say, pay me only the costs and then I'll take a share of the profits of selling copies. But that's pretty rare, and I think didn't work out well for the printers. You know, so many printing shops dissolved shortly after forming.
Bruce, would that then suggest that the bulk, 80%+ of early printing is essentially commission work?
Not the school books, but...
the big books.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, think of the two Mainz soldiers. You know, they, although it's not that we know that they were commissioned, but I think our picture, particularly in Mainz, of Fust and Schuffer is getting commitments to buy copies as printing developed. But of course, Fust was apparently quite a wealthy person. I mean, we don't know the details of it, but it suggested so. The other thing to remember is that the names you find in colophons of books, that doesn't say everybody in our printing shop. It's not like a commune. We all work together on this. The name might be that of the investor only who never dirtied his finger with a piece of type. It might be that of the printer, and there was a silent investor who maybe invested, there's certainly one Italian case, his name never appears in the colophon, but almost all the printing done in one town of Italy over more than 10 years was at his cost. He just saw no reason to put his name in the colophon. He may have thought that was a rather low thing to do.
Other questions? Oh, sorry. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, you know, this will come up in the Thursday lecture. I think I'm going to just say, wait till the Thursday lecture, every question from this point on. But it's when you get to Italy and the wonderful habit of going to a notary and drawing up contracts for so many forms of business and then the preservation of the notebooks of the notaries. There we do see some evidence on how book sales took place, even sending copies to establish stationers in groups. In Northern Europe, we don't have anything like that I can think of offhand in this early period and just a little bit later, but it's from where the copies ended up. That's in fact why the evidence of book bindings and ownership it's almost the critical new force for understanding the book trade, which was completely overlooked until, well, living memory, so to speak. It used to be nothing, and now it's almost the foundation stone.
We have time for Two more questions. Go ahead.
Did Gutenberg use the same kind of ink that was used in woodblock printing, or did he have to develop a whole new approach to ink as well?
Yeah, I mean, it was a completely different ink. And if I go back very quickly, one of the slides shows this very well indeed. I think we're getting near it, closer, pre-intermezzo there. You see here, the top part of what you're seeing is printed with a water-based ink woodblock by rubbing on the back in the black in the blockbook method. The single line you see in two columns below is the printer's ink, you know, which is a varnish-based ink, has to dry slowly, does not completely absorb through the paper, but does attach itself very deeply to the fiber of the papers. And in one of Peter Schiffer's colophons, he has a statement about the ink as not being the common ink that you, reader, are used to, but a special black ink, Atramentum. So it was very different.
I guess that was there a question in the back? Okay. All right, on that note, thank you very much again, Paul.
You're welcome.